morning, everyone. Welcome to our Lou Jones Breakfast Club. Today we're going to have Todd Koenig, he's here already, and John Pintar talk about domestic support obligations and child support obligations. They've each got an outline. They're very comprehensive. If you're not here to pick up a paper copy, go onto our website, and under the Lou Jones Breakfast tab, you'll find the outline. And by the way, just a reminder, all the outlines from all the past presentations are available there. So I hope that's a good resource for you and you're able to use that. Next month, July 9th, we are going to have, it's our first post-Summerfest presentation. We'll be having Hannah Yancey and Rob Menenga, and they'll be talking about exemptions. Always a good topic, always a lot of developments in that area. So please come on back next month. We don't have anything scheduled yet for August, so I don't know what you got cooking there, Ryan. He's got something in mind. If you've got ideas or if you'd be willing to present, please talk to Ryan Blay. He's our guy that's coordinating it this year, and we really appreciate all his good work. So Todd's going to get started. I'm sure John is trapped in the security line here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. In the remote locations, remember to send in your name to Paula to get your CLE credit, and here in Milwaukee, please sign the sign-in slip, and we'll make sure you get your CLE credit. Thanks again, Todd.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, everybody. John Pintar will be here, I'm sure, from the Wisconsin Support Collections Trust Fund to talk about his office's point of view of domestic support obligations. Those are the classic child support obligations, but the term domestic support obligation that we have today runs farther and wider than just child support. So how do you know what a domestic support obligation is? Fortunately, BAP CPA gave us a definition. Definitions found in the code 101 sub 14 capital A. Domestic support obligation is a debt that accrues on, before, or after the date of order for relief. So that's a pretty comprehensive time span, including interest, and fits four other criteria. Sub A is owed to or recoverable by. And remember those words, owed to or recoverable by, because the courts will later on parse those words. Owed to or recoverable by either spouse, former spouse, child of the debtor, such child's parent, legal guardian, or responsible relative, or a governmental unit. So there's the categories right there. In addition, a domestic support obligation also needs to be in the nature of support. And then there's where a lot of the action in the case law is to define what in the nature of support is. And also, sub B says it's in the nature of support regardless of how that claim is designated in the marital settlement agreement. So just because the marital settlement agreement says it's domestic support obligation doesn't necessarily mean it is. And sub C there, it was either established or subject to establishment. So there's another wide range right there, before, on, or after the date of the order for relief, in connection with a separation agreement, a divorce decree, or a property settlement agreement, or an order of the court. Sub D also is included in the domestic support obligation that has to do with collections. A domestic support obligation that was assigned to a collection agency is still considered a domestic support obligation to the extent that it was assigned voluntarily by the spouse. But then the reverse is opposite. If it's not assigned voluntarily by the spouse and it's assigned to a collection agency, then it loses this classification as domestic support. Domestic support obligations have a wide impact throughout the code. I started and just went in a numerical order because that's my penchant, but we might skip around. Section 362, relative to the stay, the domestic support obligations are not subject to the stay to the extent that they are, and then listed under 362B there, for the commencement of, looks like there's a typo there, it's, the word should say commencement of a civil proceeding or action for the establishment of paternity, for the establishment or modification of a support order. And John Pintar in his speech is going to suggest that modification of support orders is one of the options that could be pursued. Also concerning child custody, or it's not a stay for the dissolution of the marriage except to the extent that the dissolution seeks to affect property of the estate. Under that circumstance, then you're going to need relief from the stay. And also there is not a stay relative to domestic violence. 362A is also not a stay for the collection of domestic support obligations from property that is not property of the estate. and it is also not a stay for collection of property that is property of the estate if it was subject to a judicial or an administrative order. That's like your regular child support that's going to continue to be taken from your paycheck right during your Chapter 13 case. Stay does not...
And all to get these stipulations and sometimes even motions, like there's going to be some dispute about it, whether the stay should be lifted so that the parties, that maybe they're both in bankruptcy or one is in bankruptcy, can actually get that order of divorce. Is that not necessary anymore after BAP CPA, so that the state court should just be free to go ahead and grant these people divorces without the bankruptcy court getting involved?
Not if the divorce court is going to affect property division.
Okay,
if it's property of the estate, then you do need relief from the stay, and essentially that's what sub C, don't have my glasses here on, essentially says. If it's going to affect property of the estate, then you have to come in and get relief from the state, and you might as well figure on getting the trustee involved in that too.
Okay, but in a no asset case where everything's exempt, there's no property of the estate being implicated?
Well, it is until 30 days. There's no objection to the exemptions, and if that's all the property, wait that 30 days and then get your property division and you're fine.
Okay.
So, and if the trustee files a no asset report, then you don't have a problem.
Okay, as long as the trustees abandon the assets, then there's not assets of the estate to worry about?
Right. And technically, filing the divorce, the petition requires that you request a property division. I don't know that anybody's ever challenged that, but the statute says that the court does a property division, but I don't think that's usually a problem. There's been more litigation lately, particularly with individual Chapter 11s, where courts are a little more careful about lifting the stay, because there are some cases that say that the bankruptcy decisions in the bankruptcy court may actually facilitate the divorce and so forth. So where there's a lot of money involved, some courts have refused to lift the stay. Go ahead and administer property of the estate in the bankruptcy court and then let the divorce go forward. Don't forget our stipulation on the website too.
Right, there is a form stipulation that you can use on the website if you've got this situation, but I feel bad because I get people that are just sort of dabbling and they call in a panic because tomorrow is going to be the divorce and the state court is going, what, is one of these parties in bankruptcy? I can't proceed. And I think unless you're affecting property of the estate, you don't need our involvement to go forward with that. And
in the run-of-the-mill
no asset Chapter 7, you're not affecting property of the estate. And I really question how much you're affecting it in Chapter 13. If the plan's been confirmed and you're just, you know, making the plan payments? I don't know.
Well, then there's the Klaus case. And are you going to talk about Klaus?
No.
Should I talk about Klaus?
You can talk about Klaus.
Oh, okay.
You almost have to now.
Santa Klaus? Or
No. It's a Pennsylvania case. And the parties had been, the debtor had been in Chapter 13 for, I don't know, a year or so, didn't bother to tell his divorce attorney that he was getting divorced. And so the parties entered into a property division marital settlement agreement and for support and everything, and the judge went through every paragraph of the property settlement and determined that things like the award of maintenance required distribution of property of the estate because it was the debtor's earned income post-petition. It required transfer of the house. There were a couple of other provisions. And at least under Pennsylvania law, their severability rules are that if one aspect of the property settlement is void, the whole thing is void. And so he voided the marital settlement agreement. They'd gone to all that trouble, and it all turned out to be void because it was in violation of the stay. No relief from the stay, so they had to kind of start over. He said that he could have annulled the stay, but he wasn't going to because there was so much property of the estate involved with the debtor's income, and I guess the house was a fairly substantial asset. So, in essence, the whole thing was void. So, that can be a problem.
Be more careful in Chapter 13.
Be more careful in Chapter 13.
Bob?
Judge, I think because most of the divorce attorneys and judges are
not here,
they have at least one of your seminars.
Oh.
I think...
For that, they deserve medals. Or
something. You have a divorce, they're looking for that stipulation, irregardless.
Yeah, they probably are. Yeah, a lot of state court judges tend to be kind of gun-shy about the automatic stay. And so they want that relief from the stay.
I mean,
the
so
stipulation...
The difference that the 30 days they've expired and there's no asset report, the judge is still going to look for that stipulation.
The comment is the judge is still going to look for the stipulation. Maybe, but maybe the judge will pick up the phone and call me and I'll tell him don't bother. And so if you can talk your state court judge into calling one of us, or, you know, it sometimes can help, we can leave it there. But, and we'll also tell them, no, there's going to be a property division, there's no asset report, you know, we can look it up. So we can be helpful, I hope, in that regard. Because I know it takes, you know, a month, 2 months to get a date, court date. So the people are sitting there, you know, they don't want to wait months. And a stipulation is immediate. You know, if you're going to go through the motion route, then you have to wait for the time, you have to pay your $176, get that stipulation. Bob?
One other point of view, do all of the judges require a motion as part of the stipulation, or will you just...
There's a motion to approve the stipulation, yes.
Okay.
I mean, technically, that's what you're supposed to do. I would assume if somebody filed a stipulation, that's kind of a... If you want it approved, yeah, you got to file a motion. I mean, there may be sort of a presumed motion, but it's better to file a motion to approve the stipulation.
Best practice is to file that motion.
Yeah.
But this is the one area where I ignore that best practice all the time, because I know the parties want their divorce. You don't want to keep people married who don't want to be married. Don't have a problem with the best practice. And if you've got a big elaborate stipulation in one of your, you know, Chapter 11 cases or Chapter 13 or whatever, yes, please.
Then
please,
you definitely
please
should.
Please do that. But yeah. In this, I'm stipulating to get a divorce and property of the estate is not going to be involved, or we'll deal with that later. I don't have a problem with signing that order if you feel like you need it.
Yeah. And the stipulation says the property of the estate remains under the jurisdiction of the bankruptcy court. So it's right in there. But they can go ahead and get their divorce. Quit accumulating community property, and we have just hijacked.
Yeah,
I have to shut up.
It seems like he's not coming. Could you go and sit by him? Because the people in the remotes, they can only see him.
So I won't feel lonely.
And we really appreciate your expertise in this area.
Hi there.
So this is not John Pintar, for the benefit of the latecomers. Apparently, he's been held up unavoidably. But
sure.
We appreciate Judge McGarry. She's just a nationally recognized expert in this area. So please feel free to pop in and
there. So excellent. So the lesson there is, to the extent that there is a property division and you think that you need relief from the stay, then the form on the website is the form to use. The domestic support obligations are given priority, and the priorities are found under 507. There are A1A, and that's about as priority as you can get, A1A, A1B, and A1C. The A1As are typically the custodial child support. Our domestic support obligations that, as of the date of the filing of the petition, are owed to or recoverable by the spouse, former spouse, child of the debtor, such child's parent or legal guardian, without regard to who filed the claim. So the claimant can file the claim, or John Pintar, Support Collections Trust Fund, can file the claim on their behalf. 507A1Bs are the non-custodial child support obligations that are either assigned by a spouse to a governmental unit or are owed directly to or recoverable by a governmental unit. And those are the typical Wisconsin Support Collections Trust Funds that will file their claims under sub A and sub B. And then under 507A1C, the trustees are also entitled to some modicum of priority to the extent that the trustees administer funds under 507 A1A or A1B. They are also entitled to get payment in that priority. Exemptions and...
Well, before you leave that, the there's a difference of opinion in the case law as to whether certain kinds of governmental claims are going to be subject to priority. And we've seen that with child care expenses, sometimes even for food share or something like that, where the debtor has received government support and we call it a kind of support, and then they have to pay it back because they improperly received it or something. And some courts say, no, that's not a support obligation. It's if not fraud, a mistake, you know, something that they received improperly, and that really isn't a support obligation. But it seems to me that if it was paid for support, it's owed back for support. So there's a difference of opinion on those wrongfully received benefits as opposed to the rightfully received benefits that there's a right of recovery by the state. Stay tuned.
And absolutely, and the case law bears that out. There's because right. There's a couple of different ways you can think about
right.
that.
I had the case, and I believe it was Mike Maloney's case, and he argued and convinced me that that is not what they meant by support. A overpayment of a food share mm-hmm. or this kind of a benefit did not fit within the definition. I don't know if it was John Pintar or somebody from the state of Wisconsin, David Lang, that crowd over there. They appealed. And Judge Randa reversed, and that's the Ratliff case. And because it's a district court, this gets a lot of attention, and you know there have been other courts that have followed it, but now we're starting to see some that are disagreeing with it. And again, going back to, if you really parse through the statute, it is kind of written kind of convoluted, but I felt, obviously, and that's the way I wrote it, and now these other courts are also disagreeing with that Ratliff case. Now,
I had a case
on that one.
Yeah.
I think you had
I had a case, and I found that it was a support obligation. It wasn't appealed, and I'm kind of on the fence. So, yeah, you can look at it both ways, and both are reasonable.
Yeah, and Judge Randa in that case started off by searching out and saying, you know, the 101-14A has a wider definition than the old 523-5, and he spent a lot of time explaining why he thought it was a wider definition and expanded beyond a traditional type of a definition there. And that's actually in the materials.
And again, I'm not saying that somebody should just go ahead and steal food share benefits and get out of it in bankruptcy. I think they can be non-dischargeable under the fraud thing. I'm just not sure they should qualify for priority as a domestic support obligation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, because the definition may not lend itself in that direction.
Right.
Section 523 has the exceptions to discharge. 523A5 and A15 are the big ones for us today. 523A5 is for domestic support obligations, point blank. And then 523A15 is for other obligations that are owed to a spouse or former spouse or child that are not domestic support obligations, but that were otherwise incurred by the debtor in the course of their divorce or separation proceeding, divorce or separation, or in connection with a separation agreement or a divorce decree. 523A5, the domestic support obligation, and A15 are both non-dischargeable in a Chapter 7. Under the 727 discharge, A5 and A15 are both non-dischargeable. In a Chapter 13 case, under 1328B, which is not the standard Chapter 13 discharge, it's the discharge where you're asking for a discharge before the case is completed. Under a 1328B discharge, 523A5 and A15 are both still non-dischargeable, but under a 1328, Chapter 13, the regular discharge under 1328A, there is no longer an exception to discharge for 523A15, and those are essentially the hold harmless type agreements there. However, there has been some case law that has bootstrapped hold harmless agreements in Chapter 13 case to be domestic support obligations anyway.
Well, they may be. If the non-debtor can't keep up the expenses of the household, then the payment of the joint debts might be in lieu of support. It can be part of it. But those are the sorts of things that we used to noodle out when property division was dischargeable and support was not. We had to decide, well, was it property division or support? What pigeonhole do we put that obligation in? And that's still going to happen in a Chapter 13 case. It's more likely to come up in the context of either confirmation of a plan, which, and the plan provides that the obligation that is owed to the former spouse is property division, and if the former spouse doesn't speak up and say, no, it's actually support, then the order of confirmation may be res judicata with respect to the classification of that particular obligation. So it's something that has to be raised fairly early on, and also at the time the claim is filed, because if the spouse has checked a priority debt and it turns out that it's not, the debtor doesn't believe it's a priority debt, believes it's a property division, then the debtor's got to object to that claim. So we still have to decide whether the, here we go. We still have to decide whether it's a support obligation. John Pentar just walked in, if that's wrong. Support obligation or not at the time of the objection to claim happens. There may be also obligations such as, say, the divorce court awarded attorney's fees because maybe the debtor vexatiously multiplied the proceedings, and so they're sanctions. They're treated as sanctions. Well, that's not really support. It's sanctions. So that may be non-dischargeable. Shall I leave?
Yes, please.
Yes, please. Okay. Bye.
All yours.
No, thank you, Judge. I apologize. I thought, I don't know why, I thought it started at 9, so apparently I'm wrong.
That's too early for that. All right, I'll go ahead and wrap up,
sure.
And then and we'll let you have your time. And then just heading on toward the rest of the issues that I had here, I just wanted to point out that Chapter 7 trustees and Chapter 13 trustees have duties relative to these domestic support obligations, so don't be surprised when they press you for the name, address, and phone number of the claimant. Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 trustees have to send notice as soon as the case is filed to the DSO claimant. You have to send notice to Support Collections Trust Fund, and then at the end of the case you have to send out a whole set of new notices. So have that information ready for your Chapter 7 and Chapter 13 trustees, and don't make them ask for it. Chapter 13 plan requirements come up under Section 1322 A. A 2 and 4 is really where the fireworks are for us in 507. 1322 A 2 says point blank, 507 claims get paid in full in a Chapter 13. That's what A 2 says, that's it. 1322 A 4 says, to the extent that you have a 60-month plan and you're already committing all your disposable income to the plan and you have a 507 A1B claim, then to that extent that A1B claim does not need to be paid in full. So the only exception to not paying a priority claim in full other than that would be is if you get consent from the claimant. But reading 1322A2 and 4 together, working backwards, you can create a situation in your Chapter 13 plan where any excess money can go to be paid to a 507A1B claim before it would ever get to the unsecured general creditors. I've worked with Mary Grossman's office, and we have some language there that I've listed and is accepted by Mary Grossman's office. But the point there is to be clear about where the money's going, what the order is, and also to be clear that the only reason that we're paying a 507A1B claim less than 100% is because it's a 60-month plan. And that's I also reviewed that with Tom King's office. Tom King agrees with the concept, but this is language that was previously authorized by, or at least agreed to by, Mary Grossman's office. And then domestic support obligations for the case law. Put in a variety of case law there that gets towards some of the issues that Judge McGarrity was talking about. What if there's just been a support overpayment? There's a variety of cases that say just the support overpayment is not a domestic support obligation. It's only a claim for reimbursement. It doesn't benefit the child or the obligee. It doesn't result from a judgment for alimony maintenance or support. There's generally, as in that case that's listed, there was no evidence that payments were necessary for other support, and there was no evidence of disparity of income. And with those factors, that court said, you know, that's not a domestic support obligation. It's just an overpayment. Another court took that a step farther. The next court there that I have listed is Van Hook. That was a gentleman was ordered to pay child support, and it was late, and he paid the child support in full. It turned out later on it was not his child. Paternity was wrong. Custodial mother filed the bankruptcy. He filed a claim for as a non-dischargeable domestic support obligation, and that court said no. It's not a domestic support obligation. Support wrongfully ordered and paid does not transform the claim for a refund into priority debt. That court essentially said you can't have a child support payment if it's not your child. But
did they quote Billie Jean by Michael Jackson?
No. That was me.
That was you.
Yep,
okay,
yep, there you go.
Okay. Try to work some of that into your briefs. I enjoy a musical reference.
There you go. Billie Jean is not my lover.
It wasn't for his support. I mean, the former husband had a right to get the money back, but it wasn't for his support. So that's why it wasn't really a support debt.
Child support had continued past the termination date. Here in this other case, just to give it a little bit different flavor of that, here in this In Re Baker case, the child support had continued past the time that it was due to terminate, and apparently the gentleman who was supposed to pay the child support wasn't sharp enough to stop his own child support payments. But the court held that the wife knew full well that the child support payments were supposed to have terminated and that she continued to collect them knowing it. The court said that she did not come to court with clean hands, and that court held that to be a domestic support obligation. So that's a little bit of a bootstrap there. And then in 1998, Judge Shapiro had the In Re Tadish case, and that was a little bit thicker analysis. There was a provision in a marital settlement agreement where the husband was supposed to create a trust for the children, and Judge Shapiro held that was a non-dischargeable conveyance under 523A5. He held that it was not a property division because it was not a property division between the husband and the wife. It was just it was intended to provide support for the children. So Judge Shapiro held that non-dischargeable. Other debts in the nature of support, the case law is fairly clear that you look to federal case law to determine what's in the nature of support. All the case law says intense and important threshold that has to be crossed before other concerns become relevant, and the party seeking to hold the debt non-dischargeable actually has the burden of proof. In Re Pool there, I listed, has a series of factors to get at what intent is. There's another case called In Re Giannakis that had a longer list of these elements. That was 917 F2nd 759. But the point is, their cases are going to get through a laundry list of elements to get to determine what the intent of the debt was. I'm going to skip past a couple of those.
Well, just be careful. They may have intended that it be paid, not that they intended to be for support. You'll see plenty of marital settlement agreements that say that we intend this to be support and it's non-dischargeable, and they'll go on and on, and then it turns out that the payee really makes three times what the payor does, and it doesn't really function as support. So
agreed, and
intent is a little strong.
Intent and effect.
Yes.
Intent
function.
And effect.
Yeah.
And then the Norbert case lists that at the top of page 10. This was it's a good example of that. The ex-wife was supposed to collect alimony until her former husband's retirement, and then at that time she was supposed to get half the retirement. Well, he retired early, and so he continued to pay the alimony and also paid half of his retirement funds. Later on, she filed a bankruptcy. He claimed that the overpayment was a domestic support obligation, and the court held that it in fact was, because the former husband's payment of half his pension along with the alimony reduced his living ability. And there, right there is then has the effect of support. So it's not only the intent, but then the effect of support also. The hold harmless agreements are essentially the 523A15, and they are effective in Chapter 7s, but not necessarily under a Chapter 13, 1328A discharge. The general thought of hold harmless agreements is that a provision in a divorce decree to hold harmless or indemnify a spouse creates an entirely new debt running between the former spouses. Judge McGarity has a recent case as of April, or the she considered a marital settlement agreement which included hold harmless language and a provision classifying the payment of certain debts as domestic support obligations under 523A5, and Judge McGarity held that was non-dischargeable. It was, the facts were apparently not crystal clear, but it was either non-dischargeable under A5 or A15, and the court pointed out that the obligation that's non-dischargeable in those situations is the debtor's responsibility to hold harmless the ex-spouse. And I'll just wrap up here. Domestic support obligations owed to third parties, and that is a big deal because third parties aren't one of the laundry list of people who are entitled to claim child support, but the words that say owed to or recoverable by then opens the door for domestic support obligations for third parties. There's case law that I've listed there that says guardian ad litem fees can be domestic support obligations. Judge McGarity had the In re Lockwood case in 1992, and she said, look, it's not they're not services just related to custody and visitation, but they actually extend it to a form of support. The Ratliff case, which we've talked about a little bit, says that food stamps can be considered in the nature of support, but at the same time, that's a pretty expansive reading and may not be followed by everybody else. Attorney's fees. We have some nice cases by Judge McGarity, Wisniewski, and In re Georgie. Both held those attorney's fees to be domestic support obligation. And then also In re Hying, which was a Judge Shapiro case just before he left the bench. Attorney's fees that were awarded to the ex-wife by the family court were held to be domestic support obligations because they were legal services that related to the ex-wife's general welfare. So domestic support obligations can go far and wide. There's the definitions, and there's differences in interpretation from case law. And they were expanding and maybe are not expanding so much anymore. So that's all I've got. John?
I guess as a little follow-up through some of this and the interrelationship between child support and our office and bankruptcy, regarding the Rose Ratliff case, I believe that's the same person. When our office serves papers, we don't use the Sheriff's Department, we use a private process service company. And one of the their employees happened to be Ms. Ratliff, who unfortunately was submitting false affidavits. We had a number, at least a handful of people come in and say they weren't served. And they were credible. I mean, they were there, and how did you know about it? Happened to be the other party, and after five or so of those, at least the court commissioners stopped accepting her affidavits of service. So it seems as though that wasn't the only thing she wasn't reporting as far as benefits going.
Yeah, that would be non-dischargeable if there was a debt created out of that.
The other interesting thing here in one of these cases is regarding the child not being. Billy Jean, child is not my son. I actually had one of those, and it was a very convoluted one. The mother, the child was conceived in the state of Washington, and the person who was the father happened to be a trucker who lived in Alabama. She moved to Wisconsin, and we initiated a case. He entered, at the time there were waivers of first appearance form that after service one could mail to the court if he weren't able to appear. And he submitted one saying that he denied he was the father and even retained an attorney who I think submitted it for him, giving us jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction over him. Because he denied, the court ordered genetic tests, well actually at that time blood tests, but neither he nor the mother appeared for the testing and he was scheduled to be tested in Alabama, but he failed to go to their local office also. So a default judgment was entered. Then mom left the state. She goes back to Washington. He stays in Alabama and 15 years later files bankruptcy but doesn't notify our office, only notifies Washington, tells Washington, that state of Washington, that he's not the father, and there are blood tests showing that. Unfortunately, that wasn't true. Again, no one ever went for that test. The state of Washington stipulated a blood test, believing that, well, he's saying he's not the father, and the test came back showing he, at least that test said he wasn't the father. Mother argued it, saying that, he must have sent someone else, that of course he is. Eventually, because he also had problems a little bit like Rose Ratliff, when the pleadings were filed, we had a typo. I won't use his real name. I probably can because there was a decision on it, but just in case I can't, because it's a paternity case, I'll call him Mr. Michael instead of Mr. Michaels. We filed the pleadings with his name misspelled, saying Michael instead of Michaels, but when he was served with the pleadings, he signed for it saying he was Mr. Michael. When he submitted his waiver, he signed his, notarized his signature as Mr. Michael, and so the bankruptcy court had some problems with his credibility also, and eventually just deferred and said, I'm not getting involved in this. I'm not going to find that this is or isn't a child. If you want to argue it, you have to go to the family court, circuit court jurisdiction in Wisconsin, which he never did. So I don't know if he would have had a meritorious defense to that or not, but I would prefer, for not only for the reason of obviously that it's easier for me to argue in the circuit court, but also when the question about paternity is addressed, it goes a little bit more to just whether or not you're the biological father. After a number of years, there's typically a guardian ad litem appointed for the child to see if it's also in the child's best interest to have that judgment tossed aside. If it's tossed aside, then there is no legal father, and that child's left at a substantial disadvantage. So that's just to that. Regarding my outline, in the 1930s, legislation was created in the Social Security Act, essentially starting the AFDC program. It wasn't until 40 years later that legislation created in Section for Title 42, 4D, began the AFDC, or the Child Support Agency program. It was created for the purpose of getting support orders and assistance for the families who needed it, to help them leave the system, or if they weren't receiving public benefits, to help them avoid having to seek it. It was also intended to help the government obtain some monies back from the obligors or from the non-custodial parents to help pay for the support that the government was providing to their families. The office started out with, I believe, one attorney. We now have 15 attorneys, 12 are full-time, 3 are part-time. I believe there was also one court commissioner, and there are now 8. There's 125,040 cases that we currently have, and 44,000 non-4D. A 4D case is a case initiated where the parent either is or has applied for benefits or has received them in the past. And also, again, because we want to discourage people from having to seek benefits or seek public assistance, it's also available at no cost for anyone who requests the services of our department. The number of non-4D cases now, I believe, is about 44,000. So there are a lot of people who are going without our office's assistance, who don't have a need for it, which is great. But again, there are over 100,000 that our office does have. The system originally began with families receiving benefits, assigning their benefits, but having the option of not applying for assistance for a particular child. In other words, if someone has a child with Todd here, and then 2 years later has a child with this gentleman here in the front row. Well, he's obviously a much better payer than Tosh. So his support order may have been $100 a month or something, and Todd's only $10 a month. The amount of benefits that the person would receive for the adult, for the mother typically, and the child for two children. In the case that went to the court regarding this issue, mother had her seventh child, and the state said, okay, your benefits will go up from, I believe, $227 a month to $237. So instead of applying and receiving the extra $10 a month, she opted to not apply or not request assistance for that seventh child, where the support order was $43 a month. That was challenged, and basically the court held that she could do that. That was changed in 1984 with DEFRA, when the government began saying that the first $50 you receive of any month of support is going to go to the family, but you have to list all persons in the household as part of that family. If someone paid support order was $50 a month, they got to keep 100% of it, assuming it was paid each month. I think part of the reason for that was also to encourage people to become regular payers. If someone paid $50 one month and then $100 the next, well, the recipient family only got $50 of it, not the full 100, because it was only for timely payments. In 1998, Wisconsin went to the W-2 or Wisconsin Works program, and more money is now being funneled to the recipient families of support. Initially, it started out with the recipients of child care or W-2 getting 42% of the support paid. Now it's up to 75%. Also, and that's only if you're getting W-2. If you're receiving just the health insurance or just eligible for the child care and food stamps, you receive 100%. But our office, again, is assisting and will help collect that, but without, and that's still considered a 4D case. I suspect that Todd probably went over 11 U.S.C. 14A. I think it was a fantastic explanation.
Thanks. Yeah, we were thorough.
Typically, though, when I file a claim, I'm not going to have those issues about whether it's a support debt or not. It's pretty cut and dried or clear. If it's on our kids' printout, it's either going to be custodial arrears or interest due the parent or the state, W-2 arrears or AFDC arrears. Again, we still have some of the older pre-1988 balances out there. The issues that I was usually getting, or questions I was commonly getting, were birth expenses. Why are birth expenses a child support debt? I think that's pretty much been clarified in the 96 amendments. It's also, or 2005 amendments. I think also that there was a case in Ray Siebert that's a Seventh Circuit court decision that came out of a Western District of Wisconsin case, maybe it was Eastern District. In the 1990 or 91, there was a Wisconsin county that filed a proof of claim for birth expenses, and the bankruptcy court held that it was not a debt owed to the spouse, former spouse, or child of the debtor, that it was due the mother, who again did not qualify as a spouse, former spouse, or child. And that was appealed. The district court affirmed the bankruptcy court, so it went up to the circuit court, which held that no, that the expenses for the birth were related sufficiently enough to be a debt, although not necessarily the child may not have been the patient, the delivery initially, certainly the reason or rationale for the mother being there was because the mother was pregnant. So it held that the birth expense costs were not dischargeable. Similarly, the court costs and genetic, actually in that decision it similarly held, I think the service costs weren't dischargeable, and that's been extended to the genetic test, and now it's, I think it's pretty clear, again, that whatever's on our system has been assessed by the court is going to be a non-dischargeable debt. The only thing that we get that Todd was talking about, guardian ad litem fees, if I see it's only a guardian ad litem fee case, I'll typically send that up to the Corporation Counsel's office. But if it's part of our, if I'm filing a claim for support arrears also, I'll just go ahead commonly and add that to our claim. Things to do if there is a domestic support obligation. Notify the custodial parent, not just our office. I would also notify the state and, as I said, the child support agency where the debt emanates from. I'm saying that because, well, for a couple of reasons. One, you might know that the person has a debt in our county, so you list us, which is great. I know I'll get it. But it happens fairly often the person also has a child in another county. Ozaukee, Waukesha, Racine, Dane County, it's really fairly common that the person has obligations in more than one place. So to be safe, I would notify the state in all cases. I've seen, I don't know, 15 different addresses for the state on some of these, and the various proof of claims that I've gotten. And I'm not saying that any of them are bad because I've seen them, they've gotten to me. But I think the best one for the state is probably the P.O. Box 7935 in Madison. We can't, as regard to sort of the parent, our office is precluded or prevented from giving you the information on what her address is. We can give you her name because in fact, when I was writing this just the day before, someone called asking if the person thought they had a support obligation but weren't sure. So I went in and I verified yes, and he said, well, who is it with? He didn't know. So I said, well, I can tell you the person's name. And then I asked, does that sound familiar? And the client was in the attorney's office, and he asked him, and the person said, no, I don't recognize that name. So I can imagine how much support was provided over the years there.
I think all of us are imagining a remedy.
Ask the client if there is a current support obligation and if they're paying it. Not regularly, but often enough see cases coming through where the person has a current support obligation and isn't paying it. Again, just yesterday, I was preparing to file a claim, and I looked to see what the arrears were, and it was unusual that the current month's support, there were no arrears, and the current month's support was actually paid more than half, even though it was only that, was it yesterday, the 9th, 10th? So I looked at it, and I noticed that we got a tax intercept, state tax intercept on the 7th, which satisfied all the arrears, and there was some left, there was about $100 left over that went towards the current month's support. But that this month, we hadn't received anything. And then I, just out of curiosity, I went back to last month and saw that the payments that we were getting were from unemployment, and that the last payment of May was only a small portion of what the weekly amount should have been. So I went into unemployment and saw that his unemployment is now lapsed or has run out. So in that case, I thought this person's plan is going to fail. They have no income. Their unemployment benefits are exhausted. Perhaps they'll be eligible for an extension, but they're going to have to wait a month, and so there won't be any plan payments. For someone in that circumstance, I was mentioning this to Tom, file a motion to modify the support order. I see so many cases, well, enough cases again, where the person goes to the bankruptcy attorney because they're in financial distress, but part of that usually involves the loss of a job or income. And the first, well, your response obviously is, yeah, we're going to file bankruptcy. So many times I think you could also add to that to modify, request your support order be modified or reduced. That's a perfect instance of something where the court would look at it and give some consideration, give some extra breathing room to this person, which might help your plan be more feasible too, and not get to the point where 6 months down the road the trustee's filing a motion to dismiss because payments aren't being made. Maybe they can make them for a few months because they're getting some assistance from a roommate or a parent, but I don't know that that's going to continue indefinitely until the 5 years goes up, expires, or until they find employment. And even if it can, why not have them get the relief they'd be entitled to in filing a motion to modify the support order? Probably once a day I get calls asking me about how much does the person owe for support. I can do it. It's not my favorite thing to do. So I gave you information about how the debtor can go into the Wisconsin Child Support website and get information about not only how much he owes, but what payments have come in through his account. Sometimes what's supposed to come through their account isn't coming through their account, which raises another story about a person involving Todd, where we filed a motion for contempt against a payor because we hadn't seen support come in for 4 to 6 months. I don't remember exactly. He shows up for the court hearing, brings a check stub with him showing that the support was withheld through December, and this is probably January, and that everything had been paid. So it clearly wasn't his fault. It was the employer not deducting the support. So our office initiated an employer contempt action. 4 months or so after, when it got to the court hearing, when we had the court date obtained and the employer was supposed to appear, they sent a bookkeeper who I believe somewhat agreed or acquiesced that the support hadn't been paid. So a warrant was stayed for the employer to an adjourn date for him to appear with payments having been made, or if that hadn't occurred, then court commissioner probably would have certified it to a judge for a finding of contempt and possible incarceration, or if the payments didn't come in at that point. Well, in the adjourned hearing, the employer didn't appear, so a warrant was issued. I'm just saying that employer eventually filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy, and it was an interesting case because the child support debtor, whose wages have been held, it was now more than 12 months since the wages had been paid, so it really wasn't a priority wage claim. Also, it wasn't a priority support claim because the employer didn't have a court order for support for his child or to a spouse or anyone else. It was to the employee's child. So that gets off to a different issue. But again, if your clients are checking their payments regularly, that's another issue that can be avoided. Regarding exceptions to the automatic stay, it has no effect on the establishment of paternity or modification of support, the withholding of income that's for the current ongoing support. We will suspend the order for repayment, though. So if a person's got an order for, $200 a month plus $5 a week towards the arrears, we'll suspend that when we file a proof of claim. it indicates here that it's not, that the withholding suspension or restriction of a driver's license is an exception to the automatic stay. Although it is, according to the code, the Wisconsin statutes have a relatively lengthy, and I would say it's at least 3 pages in the statutes about how to suspend someone's driver's license. You notify the obligor, the payor. They have a right to a hearing, right to ask for an audit of their account or a financial record review to see if the balances are correct. Then they have a right to request what's called an alternative payment plan in order to retain their license. We have to offer them some type of monthly plan in order to allow them to retain their driving privileges. If they dispute what our office is proposing, they have the ability to go to the court commissioner's office and say, we're not being reasonable. You determine what should be paid. Because we're then asking, in essence, for a repayment order, we've decided, or the state has decided, that would violate the automatic stay and essentially be recovery of a debt that should be through the bankruptcy plan, so we aren't suspending driver's licenses.
Do you have about 2 more minutes? Can you do a couple highlights?
Sure. I suppose the interception of tax refunds, and I really enjoyed kind of preparing this outline, because honestly, I think I learned as much preparing for this as I do attending. And one of the things that Todd and I discussed were the interception of tax refunds, which I think you're going to find most interesting. I've decided, after reviewing this, that we're going to stop intercepting tax refunds when we get the notice of the petition of filing for Chapter 13s. It may come in too late when we get the notice, so the first year's refund will likely, in many cases, be intercepted, especially if it's filed towards the late fall, early winter, early spring. We aren't going to be able to stop that. But for future years, we get a printout what refunds has the state gotten. I'll notify Mary, and the claim will be adjusted. I'll no longer have to go through those printouts and do that. Our policy is going to be that we're going to put the restriction on the tax intercepts. Does anybody have any other thoughts or questions? I guess I put in here that I'm one attorney in one county of the state, and it's probable that you're going to find other persons and other attorneys in other counties who don't agree with what I've said here, our office does handle, 25-30% of the cases you're going to file, or they're filing state, and probably 75% of the cases you're going to file.
Great. And your phone number is on the outline. If you have questions, you could follow up with John. Thanks so much to Todd and John.
Thanks, John. It was kind of interesting.
Please come back next month, July 9th, Hannah Yancey, Rob Menenga.
I learned a lot of my own. I should have known this.
Please ask them to put a Michael Jackson reference into their outline. I'll be looking for that.
There you go.
Thank you, Todd.
And again, I apologize.